Joe, did you hear the one about the Martian?
No, I haven't.
All right, so, turns out there's life on Mars. We didn't know it before, underground. Anyway, they say, tell you what, let's establish relations. You get your average Earthling up here, we'll give you an average Martian, and we can establish relations. The two can meet and, you know, get talking. And so we try to figure out, okay, so who should go up to meet the Martian? Should it be the president? No, that's a bad idea. Should it be a scientist? And finally, they end up sending, one of our main reporters. Because why not? And the main reporter goes to Mars, and he meets this little 2 feet tall Martian. He's green, and he's got an eye, one big eye in the middle of his head, and two little antenna just twigging around. And so the reporter just gets to work. He says, hello, I'm Mike for ABC News. Y'all about 2 feet high? And the Martian says, well, I don't know about 2 feet, but yeah, we're all about this size. And so the reporter says, okay, and y'all got the one eye? Yeah, little eye, big eye, but everyone has an eye. And he says, okay, and I see you've got the two little stalks. I say, yeah, three stalks, four stalks, but generally a couple of stalks. And the reporter says, and the beanie on your head, you know, everyone wears the beanies. And the alien blinks and says, well, not the goyim.
Planet Earth, an age of abundance. It's an era of entertainment in which mankind suffers from a loss of direction and a paralyzing plethora of leisure choices. Only the Vox Duo can navigate the deluge of delight that is the Golden Age.
And that was in honor of Harlan Ellison. And I don't know that much about the man. I didn't read much science fiction like Joe did, but I was heavily involved in reading comics, and a lot of comic book figures tended to have relationships with Harlan Ellison. And one thing, if you were friends with Harlan Ellison, is that you could always expect random phone calls. And according to multiple sources, from the editors of magazines to Neil Gaiman to Clifford Meth, and so on and so forth, what would happen is that they would receive a ring, and without preamble, Neil, got a joke for you. He may have mentioned the joke, or he may have just launched into it. You heard the one about the Martian? And that joke in particular was told by Mr. Ellison himself back in the 70s.
So I think our listeners are probably wondering, who is this Harlan Ellison that we're speaking of? Because there was a flurry of obituaries in the national newspapers and newspapers, some of them around the country, mentioning his death. But I would venture to say a large part of our audience is probably completely and entirely unaware of who Harlan Ellison is. And I think they really have no reason to know who he was. Honestly, we have no reason to know who he was, given that the bulk of his creative work was published between 1955 and 1980, so he'd already substantially slowed down his creative output before we were even born.
Yeah, I think he wrote episodes of Babylon 5, maybe, for Straczynski, so you would have watched those, but he was the sort of creator whose presence rippled, you know, on through the generations. You know, you ask modern day writers who their influences were, and Harlan Ellison is a very common name. So it was big news when he died on June 27th.
It was big news. Just to give a brief snapshot of who he was and what his career looked like. He was a writer, and he was a writer in the very real sense of the term being a writer. He was an artist, and he wasn't just in science fiction or just in comic books. He really felt that his writing spanned genres and was of interest to a lot of different people, and a lot of different communities recognized him for that. In 1993, he was given the World Fantasy Award for Lifetime Achievement. He actually wrote quite a bit of stuff that would be considered horror. He was given in 95 the International Horror Guild's Living Legend Award. In 96, he was given the Bram Stoker Award. And in 2000, he was named World Horror Grandmaster at the World Horror Convention. So he was big in a lot of areas, not just in science fiction. And then, of course, in science fiction, he was, in 2006, the Science Fiction Writers of America gave him their Grandmaster Award. So he really was accomplished across all genres, winning 8 Hugos. And those are the science fiction community's award for... what fans appreciate. And then he also won 4 Nebulas, which is when your writing peers decide to recognize the work you've done. And he was also a large part of his career was in writing for television as well. Writing for Babylon 5, I believe you're right there, wrote notably what we'll be talking about tonight, 1 Star Trek script, wrote a couple of scripts for The Outer Limits, and was recognized for his TV work by winning 4 awards from Writers Guild of America for his TV scripts. So as you say, he was hugely influential just because he had a huge amount of output and worked in multiple different mediums.
Yeah, and he had the personality to match. He was from a time period... come to think of it, that kind of played up that particular cantankerous, rather reckless, independent sort of person. You know, he fits in real well with, who is the creator of Gonzo Reporting?
Hunter S. Thompson.
Hunter S. Thompson. You know, and a number of other characters like that. He was one of those larger-than-life type figures, and I think that that played well into his mystique.
And he comes from that time period where it seemed you could actually have an interesting biography with perhaps not even really trying very hard. He was born in 1934 in an Ohio town, or in Cleveland, actually, and he was the son of a dentist, so... you would think reasonably well off, but he described Cleveland as being very anti-Semitic, and he was beaten up regularly by his classmates and wasn't really happy growing up. And then at 13, he ran away from home and joined a carnival, was picked up 3 months later in Kansas City, Missouri, was home for a little bit, and then ran away to Canada, probably figuring that it would be a bit harder for people to track him down and force him to come home if he left the country entirely, but worked in a lumber camp in Canada, and then also worked on tuna boats, Galveston, Texas, and drove a truck carrying nitroglycerin on a construction job in North Carolina. This is all information that was in the obituary that the LA Times wrote for him. But just, you know, it seems like people from that time period, you hear about those kinds of biographies more often than you do now. But he had one of them where a lot of different influences in his formative years before he really turned to writing.
Yeah, that is one of those biographies that you're almost a little jealous of, isn't it? The thing, I guess there's probably a lot of survivorship bias when it comes to those sort of biographies. people who did not go on to be famous writers, people who did have the job on the tuna boat or who did have the job at the lumber camp but simply stayed there, which isn't nearly so interesting. But yeah, he did have he came to the work of being a writer with a lot of experience. And I think that's a very important and element. If you're going to become a writer, if you're going to communicate through story or whatever other medium you choose, then it's important to have something to say. And Ellison did.
Oh, he absolutely did. And I always struggle when I talk about the difference between writing and storytelling, or between literature and non-literature. I personally always struggle to put into words exactly what it is that I'm thinking of and what it is that I'm meaning. So I'm always happy when I find someone who does the hard work for me, and then I can just kind of surf off of their efforts. And reading up on Harlan Ellison in preparation for this episode, found a quote from the author David Gerrold, talking about who Harlan Ellison was and what made Harlison special as a writer. David Gerrold said that David was a storyteller. He writes stories, he tries to make things clear and understandable and interesting, but he's not really going for high-flying prose. But then he has this to say: Harlan Ellison is a writer. And that's a whole other kind of critter than a mere storyteller. Language pours from his typewriter in a torrent of words. Visions explode like anger-filled hand grenades. Liquid images flow onto the pages, neon-streaked, high-voltage, screaming charges of emotion, vibrating with pain and horror and rage. Harlan writes with words as clean as surgical-grade stainless steel, as hard as lunar diamonds, as bright as a roaring solar flare, as precise as a neurosurgical laser, and as deadly as a monofilament wire tightening around your neck. At his very best, when his most exquisitely crafted work shatters through the bland oatmeal of your everyday existence into the pulsating wet heart of your conscious self, Harlan writes of emotions so rare and precious and altogether human that in the act of reading, the reader transcends his own limitations and is expanded to a new level of receptivity to the universe around him. Do you see what I mean about the difference between writers and storytellers? And I picked up a volume of some of Ellison's short stories from the library and managed to read just a couple of them. But I can absolutely see what David Gerrold is referring to here. The writing, his short stories are vivid and expressive and emotional. And in one case, kind of just punch you straight in the face as you're reading. They're not something you can easily ignore or look past. And it's kind of rare to see that in someone who can write very human stories that are at the same time very visceral.
Would that I had similarly researched as prose. All I have to go on is our primary sort of subject of the day, which we decided to do sort of in memoriam. Arguably his most mainstream work, a Star Trek episode that is, I believe, considered by fandom to be the best that ever was.
Yeah, every so often votes are taken, and I don't know how it ranks up if you put all five Star Trek series together, but if you're talking the original series, which I think, just to simplify things, whenever we say Star Trek from now on, we will be referring to the original series that aired in the 60s. Whenever you have fans vote on Star Trek episodes, City on the Edge of Forever always tops every list. It's the rare episode that has a full dose of emotion and interesting story and good acting, good setups. There are other stories that are popular with fans because they're fun, but this one I think is popular with fans because it's meaningful.
I don't have a whole lot of experience with the original series of Star Trek either, so I don't know how it compares to most, but I definitely enjoyed the story. And since I'm the person who's new to it, I guess I'll be the one to summarize it. How's that? So what happens is that the ship is moving along, and due to turbulence, Bones, the medical officer, accidentally shoots himself up with a drug that essentially makes him crazy.
Paranoid.
As you will. Paranoid Bones then proceeds to transport himself down to the nearby planet from which they are receiving strange readings. Long story short, Bones manages to find the energy source. It's a sentient time portal. And he jumps in, thereby changing the past and causing the entire universe essentially to change. Because at this point, Starfleet has, you know, roamed the galaxy, and so whatever affects Earth's history is going to have severe effects on alien civilizations for light years. Captain Kirk and trusty sidekick and science officer Spock go into the past, which turns out to be the Great Depression era in New York, in order to stop Crazy Bones from whatever he's about to do that so drastically changes the timeline. And what happens is they find that it's all centered around a particular and beautiful woman, a woman who's running a homeless shelter named Edith Keeler.
Keeler.
I think her last name's Keeler.
Yep.
Edith Keeler. Edith Keeler is pretty. She's an optimist. And of course, Kirk immediately falls for her. The assumption is probably that Bones is, who's still out of his mind, is going to kill her, and that she is meant to do something important. In fact, Bones essentially snaps out of it after a while. The drug wears off, and he comes back to his senses. What Bones does wrong is that he saves her from a simple auto accident. Kirk spends essentially most of the episode wrestling, trying to find Bones, and wrestling with the possibility that this new woman he's found, whom he loves, is someone who is meant to die. Spock has less of a problem with this, and essentially argues that she must. When it comes to the dreaded moment, Bones tries to save the woman Edith, but Kirk makes his decision and grabs him, stopping him from pushing her out of the way of a semi. Edith Keeler proceeds to perish, and the timeline is saved. Kirk and Spock and Bones all return to the future, where Kirk curses. And that is notable because it was apparently the first time that was done in mainstream television. Not a terrible curse. He doesn't drop the F-bomb, more's the pity. But he does say, let's get the hell out of here. Which inexplicably did not catch on as well as Beam Me Up, Scotty.
Opportunities missed.
Did I get most of that right, Joe?
Yeah, you got most of it right. It's also something you passed over. They find out that the reason she's important in the timeline is her message of hope and of tolerance and of acceptance is decades ahead of its time. And if she lives, she becomes rather an influential figure in New York and then eventually in the nation, such that she spreads enough of a message of peace that it delays the United States' entrance into World War II, giving Germany time to develop the atom bomb before America does, leading to Hitler winning World War II, which then, of course, changes the entire path of human history. And that's important just because it lines up with the rest of Harlan Ellison's career. Actually, no, it doesn't. That's important for later in the podcast, the message that she's speaking. But in the story, the way it plays out is, yes, she's important because she has to die so that the U.S. will enter the war earlier and win the war, and then the timeline will proceed as it should. And that's just a story element that's been repeated over and over and over throughout Star Trek, if not elsewhere. So I want to kind of get your reactions to, and this is a little bit tough because you haven't watched a ton of Star Trek, so you don't have a lot to compare it to. But as a story, what did you think about the episode? Because I rewatched the episode recently, and I did enjoy it. It was a very well-received episode. The episode, as shot, won the Hugo Award for Best TV Presentation of the Year from science fiction fans. What was your reaction to it?
I thought it was fun. There was You know, even if you're not a Trekkie, much like just picking up a Superman comic, you know, there's enough knowledge in the mainstream to where I think most Americans who watch an episode of the original series of Star Trek kind of know what they're getting into. There are pleasant surprises in that there's, you know, there's the second level where beyond that general knowledge, when you start to figure out these character dynamics, like the relationship between Kirk and Spock was amusing, and I didn't really remember it at all. I knew that Spock was the trusty assistant, but the relationship they have where Kirk kind of needles him a little bit, especially when he wants him to do something and tries to play off his ego, is entertaining. Incidentally, my minor question that I continuously wondered throughout the episode, are Vulcans meant to have a greenish tint to their skin?
Yes. Yeah, canonically, Vulcan blood is green. Spock's blood in particular isn't quite, because he's half human, half Vulcan. But greenish tint is what Vulcans are supposed to look like.
Okay, I kept noticing a very subtle greenish tint to his face and thought, well, that can't be an accident. So that sets that up. So, you know, I enjoyed that. The elements of humor that you don't necessarily see, such as when Kirk passes Spock off as Chinese.
And mentioning that his ears look the way they do because he had an unfortunate accident with a mechanical rice picker in his childhood.
Right. See, all this stuff is great fun. The first act takes a little bit longer to set up than it necessarily needed to. You know, first first Sulu gets wounded in the turbulence that's shaking the ship, and then Bones comes. I don't know. I think there was a little bit of heavy lifting there to get us where we wanted to go. So for a little while, I was waiting. But after that, you know, when things get cracking, I thought it moved along well, and I was engaged for the whole of the episode.
Oh, fantastic. There is a production note that I'd read about that has amused me ever since I first read of it.
I think I know what you're about to say. Go on.
Yeah, if you've previewed my show notes at all, you know where I'm going with this. When Kirk and Spock and the rest of the team are first landing on this planet, it's supposed to be a planet of great antiquity, super, super old. And so on the TV show, when they land, this is represented by various stones and pillars that are fallen over and a little bit smashed, broken in half. Looks like kind of the ruins of a Greek temple, maybe, after 10,000 years and a couple of earthquakes. And that's what we get for antiquity. Now, this is not exactly what it was supposed to be. There was supposed to be an actual ancient city far off on a ridge high up in the mountains. And, well, I'll just quote DC Fontana, who was one of the writers on Star Trek at the time, because I think she tells the story wonderfully. As the episode approached production, there was a glitch in the art direction. Star Trek's art director, Matt Jeffries, fell ill with the flu just as the episode was going into preparation. The department head, Bud Brooks, stepped in to avoid any delay. He read the script, came up with set sketches, and got the carpenters going on the planet set. When Matt returned, he went down to the stage to look at it, and his mouth dropped. What the hell is that? He was looking at a gray planet surface on which there were scattered broken Grecian columns, tumbled walls, and statues. Bud explained that they were the ruins as called for in the script. Matt couldn't recall any ruins. Bud opened the script to the planet description and then said, "Oops." As Bud tells the story, he'd had two drinks with dinner the night he read the script and was puzzled by a description of rune stones covering the landscape. These are stones with runes carved into them. He had flipped through his dictionary and come to ruins before he got to runes. Deciding it must have been a typo, he had proceeded to design the ruined stones of the planet. And that's how you get one vision in the script of a very ancient city with certain kind of stones around it transformed into a busted up Grecian temple. And that has just amused me ever since, the small things that can change visuals immensely.
And they didn't change it.
No.
They didn't go back.
Once you're ready to shoot, you don't have time to go back and change it.
No, time is money. Chop, chop.
Exactly.
Part of the mystique of this episode is that while Harlan Ellison wrote the script for it, he only wrote the original draft, essentially, and it was heavily edited and rewritten by Gene Roddenberry and the writer's room, which Harlan Ellison was not remotely pleased with. So what we see is a bolderized version of his original intention. So for this podcast, we have not only rewatched the episode in question, but we have read an adaptation of the original screenplay, which was done in comic book form quite recently.
I find it interesting just hearing your perspective that there was the script and then it needed extensive rewrites and that Ellison was essentially unhelpful with all of that, because that actually is one of the common conceptions of how this episode came to be and how its genesis was. But I don't know that it's one that's entirely accurate.
Now, how's that?
Well, the definitive story, I think, is what Harlan Ellison himself published in 1996. After a bit of badgering, he published a small book called The City on the Edge of Forever, the original teleplay. And it is the original first draft. Actually, it's the original two story treatments before you even get to writing the draft of the teleplay. And then it's his first draft and a second draft that he'd done after getting some feedback and having some conversations with Gene Roddenberry. But the more interesting part of this book is the roughly 50 or 60% of it he spends laying out his side of the story, very, very angry over the public version that's been given out for the past 30 years, been given out by Gene Roddenberry. And the version you're familiar with is essentially Gene Roddenberry's version of the story. There was a script from Harlan Ellison. It was okay, it had potential, but it needed a lot of work, and Ellison didn't want to hear anything about his script being less than perfect, and so Roddenberry was forced to step in and do the work that needed to be done to make it into something that was suitable for television. And this is something that really made Ellison furious. And that's one of the things I think you have to understand about Ellison, if this story is going to make any sense. Ellison had a very volcanic temper. It was something that he was really well known for all over Hollywood. And it was actually something, curiously enough, that Michael Crichton wrote about, which is not someone who I would have expected to mention it. But Michael Crichton wrote a foreword to this volume of Ellison's short stories that I've been reading. And Michael Crichton talks about the time that he actually met Harlan Ellison in person. And he starts off by talking about an episode in L.A. in 1970 when Crichton was busy working on a screenplay, got a job from a producer to do something else. Crichton said, "I'm busy, I can't do it at the moment, but can I suggest you get Harlan Ellison? I've heard he's fantastic for this sort of thing." And as Michael Crichton relates it, there was a long, chilly silence at the other end of the phone before the producer finally, "Do you, know Harlan Ellison?" And Crichton said, "No, I've just seen the stuff he's done, and it's pretty good." And the producer says, "Well, let me tell you something." And he launched into a short, energetic, and wholly unprintable description of his feelings on the subject of Harlan Ellison. The outburst ended as abruptly as it began, and he got off the phone, leaving me completely mystified. I could only assume that there had been some bad blood, but that's hardly a rare event in Hollywood, and I thought no more about it. Except for the fact that Crichton, over the next couple of years, kept running into people where he'd dropped the name Harlan Ellison, and they would all essentially react the same way. Stunned silences, pauses, and then, "Do you actually know Harlan?" And Crichton was told that Ellison was a perfectionist, he cared too much about his work, he fought for ideas, he was demanding, and he was quick to pull his name from projects, which Crichton says, "Hey, I didn't mind, because I thought that was just a mark of being a good writer, that you actually cared about your stuff." And I would have taken that as just an interesting perspective from Michael Crichton, except that as I was reading obituaries and as I was reading up on Harlan Ellison and as I was reading his own writings, it came across that this was a very accurate description of him. He cared a ton about his work. Really, really wanted it to be professional. And if you tried to bowdlerize it into something that was less good, he didn't react well to that. He definitely fought for his ideas. And he actually had a pseudonym that he would frequently use, Cordwainer Bird. And if you saw Cordwainer Bird on a story, one, you knew it was Harlan Ellison, and two, you knew it was his opinion that whatever that story was had been hacked into something that was far, far less than it could have been. As Ellison said, everyone in the industry knew Cordwainer Bird was Ellison standing behind this crippled thing saying, "It ain't my work," and sort of giving the bird to those who had mucked up the words.
Right.
So to talk about this script, Ellison spent years being angry about it because it attacked his professionalism. The story around the script attacked his professionalism. He was a writer who had written for multiple TV shows and had had multiple very well-received episodes for TV shows before he wrote for Star Trek, was specifically called in by Gene Roddenberry to write for Star Trek, and agreed to do it, and then sat down and turned out a script that he felt was very, very good. He gave it to Gene. It eventually aired on television, and then Gene spent the next 30 years telling people that the story, as Ellison wrote it, was impractical, it was unfilmable, it wasn't that great, it was too expensive for television. Ellison's a nice guy with really great ideas, but his story needed a lot of extra work. And so a lot of Ellison's anger here was professional in nature. He knew that what he had written was a very, very good story, and Gene Roddenberry was publicly running it down and slandering him professionally, not just personally. And as to the budget thing, there was kind of like, as I read Ellison's essays about his screenplay, there was three things that he kept coming back to over and over and over. One was the fact that Roddenberry had said that the story was unfilmable and not that great. One was that it was too expensive for television. And one was that Roddenberry spent years telling people that Harlan Ellison had had Scotty selling drugs on the Enterprise. And the story was, in fact, very good. Ellison was angry that Gene Roddenberry was saying it was too expensive for television, because Ellison was a television professional at this point. He knew how to make stories that could come in and hit a certain budget, and he was always very willing to work with producers to make changes to the story so that if it needed to come in cheaper, here's how we can rework scenes to make it come in cheaper. And he gives some examples of how he'd done some of this stuff on other shows. But all Roddenberry kept repeating over and over and over and over at Star Trek conventions was, this was way too expensive and of a script. Ellison had no idea what he was writing for television. And then, of course, now that you've seen the teleplay and the graphic novel version of it, you know, Scotty doesn't even appear in the original story. And yet Gene Roddenberry spent 30 years over and over and over, convention after convention, telling people Ellison had Scotty selling drugs on the Enterprise. So it was a lot of just professional anger that Ellison felt like he spent 30 years being slandered for his script and really just wanted people to know that, no, I did a good professional piece of work, and I think my story is better than Roddenberry's version of the story.
Yeah. You, now that you've said all that, I'd like to point out that it does come down to who you believe a tad there. I don't know. You know, the image of Ellison that we have, that we clearly have, is one of this loud-mouthed jerk with a heart of gold, who, you know, keeps butting heads with all these spineless commercialists. And those are very clear archetypes. And so immediately what goes off in my head is, this is probably a story. Because that's what it is. It sounds like a story. And when you have simple stories like that, it's probably not the case. Also, what comes to mind is that, as the old maxim, that if you keep running into jerks, then in fact, you're probably the jerk. So there's a lot of evidence there about, as each person in turn, anecdotally, runs into Michael Crichton and says, oh God, you're Harlan Ellison? Let me tell you about Harlan Ellison. That makes me wonder. One anecdote I ran across as we were researching this show was that of Harlan accepting the award for the city at the on the edge of forever. And one of the, he didn't sit with the Star Trek crew at the table. He went up there to get the trophy. And one of the writers at that table, before the announcement was made, thought to himself, Harlan better not get that trophy because I worked really hard on that script. But then after Harlan got it, fine, everyone applauded. But then Harlan started going to town on the Star Trek crew and about how, you know, it's amazing that the trophy got, that he got the trophy with the version of the script that ended up getting into the place, or, you know, that ended up seeing the screen. So I'm not willing to take it all at face value. Harlan Ellison is this romantic image in everyone's mind, and people like Tony Stark are a lot of fun on screen and to talk about, but they are absolutely obnoxious in real life. That, I mean, on the other hand, though, I mean, are you going to, am I going to not empathize with writers who just want to make things good? Absolutely not. You, Joe, know my own struggles. Occasionally I have vented to you about them. So certainly he has my empathy, and I hope he, and I'm glad that he fought for what he did.
The story you relate of, if Harlan wins, I'm just going to die, is actually the, like I say, the introduction to Harlan's version of the teleplay is fascinating, in part because every bit of Harlan's vitriol and anger and frustration comes through. One thing I can respect him for is he is not an author who pulls his punches or covers up the way he feels. The way he feels comes through 100% loud and clear. And he lays out in great detail pretty much every story that had ever been told about City on the Edge of Forever and his relationship to it, and then goes on and refutes it and gives his own version of the events, often with actual documentary evidence, letters that were written at the time, telegrams that were received, stories that were published.
You saying that he actually addressed this?
He addressed this exact story.
Oh, wow. Okay, let's hear it.
In fact, Gene Roddenberry did not rewrite Harlan Ellison's script. Gene Roddenberry took credit for other people rewriting Harlan Ellison's script, although Roddenberry claimed for the next 30 years that it was his rewrites. The Writers Guild Award ceremony is the one that the story was about, and Roddenberry was in the audience, and or Roddenberry was just hanging around with one of the producers the night the awards were being given out. And the producer asked Gene, why aren't you feeling so great tonight? And Gene Roddenberry says, there are two scripts up tonight for the Writers Guild Award, and I wrote them both. One of them was by Harlan Ellison, and if Harlan wins, I'm going to die.
Oh, okay, that was Gene Roddenberry himself, in theory, who said that.
Right. And Harlan Ellison goes on to just rip that to shreds, because in fact what won the award for the Writers Guild was not Roddenberry's script, it was Harlan Ellison's first draft. And the way those awards work is the writer himself has to submit his own work, and then it's anonymized, fed to a panel of judges who rank everything, and then come down and pick the final award, but it is based on whatever the writer submitted. And what Ellison submitted was his script, not Gene Roddenberry's script or anything else. So it's a story about how everyone's saying about how they saved Harlan Ellison's script and it won awards and Harlan Ellison took credit for it, but it was really other people's work that he was taking credit for. And yet this is just one more story when in fact it was his own work with nobody else's alterations at that point that won the award. And yeah, he took credit for it because it was his work. And then other people go around trying to say that they helped him out and he was just an ungrateful little snot.
Well, all right.
Yeah, I almost wish I had time to read huge chunks of this. One, because it's interesting, and two, because the way Harlan writes it is just entertaining in and of itself. I do think there are probably parts where he's making himself sound better than he actually was, because the evidence is that he had a colossal... Well, in fact, I'll just quote DC Fontana again. He had a volcanic temper, was well known for it. When the rewrites needed to happen for The City on the Edge of Forever, because Roddenberry decreed it, DC Fontana said, "Now the story can be told because Harlan has mellowed over the years. Used to be, his temperature burned at such a low firing point and with such high explosivity that it devastated buildings for 10 square miles around Ground Zero when it went off. You've heard of the H-bomb? There are still places on the Paramount lot where nothing will grow. Now, however, it's maybe only 3 square miles around that are leveled. And I live at least 6 miles from Harlan, so I can tell the story." So I do think there's places where he tries to make himself sound better. But like I say, he lays out pretty much everything negative that was ever said, refutes it, has evidence, and his writing style is... it's fantastically worth reading just because the style of writing is entertaining.
Well, grand. I'm going to have to... fill in on that gap in my education. This year's a good time to do it. So how about we talk about the episode itself? Because I am interested in going through and comparing it to the teleplay. Because, you know, in some ways, and I can't say to what degree, for example, Ellison had an influence on this, but I think the aired TV show did make improvements on the original teleplay.
So let's talk about this teleplay, Harlan Ellison's first draft, as untouched by anybody else, as translated into comic book form rather than to on the screen. This was a 5-issue series from IDW, published in 2014. The whole bundle sells for about $5 on Comixology, although their website is currently listing it for just 99 cents for all 5. So if you're listening to this episode and you're at all remotely interested in any of this, get yourself over to Comixology's website, because if it's still a buck, it's a fantastic deal, and you should pick it up and check it out.
For $5, it's a good deal. I mean, it's a full, trade paperbacks worth of story. It's 5 issues?
5 issues.
Yeah, that's not bad at all. And the comic itself is pretty well done, I think. What you have is, essentially the dialogue that Harlan Ellison wrote distributed across various panels, and all of them are painted. And some of it's, uninspiring painting from TV stills of William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and so forth. But when the artist is a little more liberated, for example, when he has a chance to draw the USS Enterprise or time distortion and stuff, there's some really gorgeous work in those issues.
Yeah, there absolutely is. That was one thing I enjoyed looking at. It was the TV stills, the artwork in some of those is awkward. But at the same time, it really helps to visualize, having that semi-realistic style helps to visualize what it would have looked like had it actually been a Star Trek episode, especially if you're a Star Trek fan and you're familiar seeing this semi-realistic story, or art style rather, it really helped me to imagine I was watching it rather than just reading it.
In some ways, it looks better. I mean, you know, the special effects dependent parts anyway, because as is, has been said many a time, you know, comics have no special effects budget.
No more so than any other part of the budget. Yeah, I love that about them.
Right. So, just going into the differences, from the beginning, and I think we'll go fairly fast, but they're important. I think the main difference, if you had to name one, is that Bones does not go crazy in the original teleplay. There is an evil Star Trek officer. His name is Beckwith. I believe he was named after a conservative politician, actually. And Beckwith is a drug dealer. He sells crystals, which don't look anything like, you know, what we have here that go by that name. They're sci-fi crystals that cause you to hallucinate. And he gets caught because one of his customers starts losing his cool while he's on the bridge of the deck, on the bridge, and flees the ship. He manages to force himself into the transportation room and beam down to the planet where, of course, they are reading those strange energy signatures. And Beckwith is played up as this very vile, kind of one-dimensional villain, which is actually important for the themes that Ellison wants to explore. And so Spock and Kirk follow Beckwith into the Great Depression era, New York City, when he changes the timeline. And the search for Beckwith takes up a fair amount of their time, and there are brief clashes throughout the story. And you see some stubs of all this. Like in the actual episode, there's this odd point which seemed rather senselessly cruel when I first watched it, when Crazy Bones passes out in an alley and a passing hobo picks up his phaser and accidentally blasts himself into complete oblivion. And this is not followed up on at all, really. It's at most it's a laugh, but there's an odd tone to it. I'm not sure if it was supposed to be comedic or not.
No, and it's this weird vestigial element to the story, like an organ that never quite disappeared after it had no use.
Right, much like the title of the episode itself. You wonder why they never bothered to rename it. Maybe you couldn't due to union rules or something, actually. I don't know.
Yeah, it as Ellison wrote it, it has a double meaning. As I mentioned before, the original stage directions call for this rather ancient-looking city high up on a ridge, and there's the time vortex on the planet that goes through all of history, past and present and future, and so it is literally a city that sits on the edge of forever. But it's also a dual reference to New York City, because all of the action happens in New York City, and New York City, in a sense, is also a city on the edge of forever, because if a certain thing does or doesn't happen, the history of the galaxy changes in very dramatic ways. But you only get half of that on the TV show, because, unfortunately, the actual set design didn't quite have that ancient city in it.
Yep. Dope. You can certainly see to some extent why Ellison was unhappy. So Beckwith versus Bones is the big divergence. It's kind of funny that we're talking about an episode about divergent timelines, and that we have two divergent episodes of the script. It almost seems like there's room for exploration there somehow of another Star Trek episode where things go differently. I don't know what I'm thinking of here, but it fires my imagination a little bit. Anyway, the rest of the changes are mostly for efficiency and tone, but this one change I think really alters the episode. I talked earlier about how the episode is, or I guess maybe I didn't, but so the episode is basically this moral dilemma. You know, Kirk, does he save the woman he loves, or does he save the galaxy or the universe and the timeline he knows and all the people in it? But this goes deeper. This is far more explored. I mean, you kind of get a hint of that in the original episode, or in the actual episode, because peace, of course, is a good thing, and peacemakers are good things. And so you've got this, you know, this squelching of a noble impulse that will lead to negative outcomes. By getting rid of Edith Keeler's attempt to make peace, you know, you are preserving life, which, of course, is very uninstinctive. So, you know, you've got that little bit of peace and war thing, but that's far more developed in the script, because in the original teleplay, it's not that Kirk, that Bones fails to save her. It's that Beckwith fails to save her. The big twist in the original teleplay is that the vile villain that they've been chasing just happens upon Edith Keeler when she's about to be run over by a semi, and he does the right thing and pushes her out of the way, and thereby changes the timeline. Whereas in the Star Trek episode, the twist is that Bones actually gets better, and he's perfectly fine when he runs across Edith Keeler, and it's the heroic Bones that saves Edith, as opposed to the evil, or rather paranoid, Bones that kills her. So you've got this parallel there, where Beckwith is evil but saves Edith Keeler, and they are allowing evil to occur, or at least they're preventing peace in that era, but preventing a lot more evil later in the future. And perhaps I've rambled a little bit, but you see what I'm saying here. This is far more developed in the teleplay than in the episode.
Yeah, it's significant that Beckwith in the original teleplay is the one that tries to save Edith Keeler, because there's been some interesting interchanges earlier in the teleplay where the citizens of New York have spotted Spock as an alien. They're thinking of him as Chinese rather than as Vulcan, but they react very aggressively. He's the cause of the Depression. He's the one taking jobs. He's the one taking food out of the bellies of their children. And they try to mob him, and he and Kirk have to run for it. And then Spock is very negative towards the ancient residents of Earth, referring to them multiple times as barbarians. And Kirk is rather weakly trying to defend his species against this entirely accurate charge. And this is very typical Harlan Ellison pointing out this kind of uncomfortable incident in Earth's history. And then we get to Beckwith, in some ways the epitome of the evil Earthman who's still a barbarian. And he tries to save Edith Keeler, and Spock at the end of the teleplay is saying, "I don't understand why Beckwith tried to save Edith Keeler." And Kirk answers and says, "We look at our race, this parade of men and women, and the unbelievable harm and cruelty they do. And we sigh and we say, perhaps our time is past. Let the sharks or the cockroaches take over." And then, without knowing why, without even thinking of it, the worst among us does the great thing, the noble deed, that spark of impossible human godliness. And we say, perhaps the human race is entitled to a little more sufferance. Let them keep trying to reach the dream. And this is just a very strong point to the episode, is that even the worst of us can do great things. So maybe there's hope for all of us after all, even though it looks dire.
I'll note that monologue by Ellison is just a little too edged by half. That it needed a little bit of sanding down, because you can't quite see TV 50s or 60s Kirk saying that, just let the sharks and cockroaches take over.
It's something you can imagine Kirk from movie number 6, The Undiscovered Country, the older, more reflective Kirk. It's something you can imagine him saying, but yes, you can't quite imagine TV Kirk being that brutal.
Yeah, I agree, and I like Ellison's sort of a more social commentary in the teleplay. Not only is there this sort of brief glance at racism and the like in that teleplay, but also this. What am I saying here? I think that in the episode, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I detect sort of more of a brush off of the idea that peace was the right answer, or you know that it was the wrong choice for the time. It's only 20 years removed from World War II, and so a peacemaker from then is still seen as more of a
Chamberlain-esque figure.
Right, exactly. So I don't know. I feel like in some ways she doesn't hit as strongly as she might, or that warps it a little bit. This is a thought not fully formed in my head. Maybe it'll come to me as we go. Regardless, yeah, so Beckwith versus Bones and all of these extra themes that come with the inclusion of Beckwith, that's what you really lose here. That's the meat. I think the rest is...
Well, the other thing you've lost, and what you didn't mention yet...
Do tell.
...is in the altered version of the timeline... In the teleplay, it's because Beckwith rescues Keeler, and in the TV show, it's because Dr. McCoy rescues Keeler. Then we have the restoration of the original timeline, which in the television show, McCoy tries to save Edith Keeler, and Kirk grabs a hold of him and prevents him from doing so. In the teleplay, Beckwith tries to save Edith Keeler, Kirk starts to intercept him and then stops and is unable to bring himself to do so because he loves Edith Keeler. And even if it's going to risk ruining the timeline, he doesn't care. He's willing to save her life at the expense of the rest of everything else. And it is Spock that steps forward, coldly logical, and runs across the street and restrains Beckwith so that Beckwith can't save Edith Keeler, so that Edith Keeler can die and the timeline can be restored. And we've actually seen earlier in the teleplay that, in fact, Spock has a phaser and is prepared to use it to kill Edith Keeler himself, if need be, in order to restore the timeline. And that's also a very significant difference between the two, is that in one, Kirk is willing to let her live and let the rest of time go. And in the other, Kirk is not willing to do that. He will sacrifice her to save the rest of time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. And of course, we know which is more interesting.
Absolutely. And this is one of Harlan Ellison's complaints about the rewritten version of his storyline, why he thinks the rewritten version is inferior. Because the rewritten version, having Kirk do the right thing, turns it into just a standard episode. The captain does the right thing because the captain's a hero, and heroes always do the right thing, no matter how painful it may be. Ellison's actual quote on this is, "That was the first time I ever heard that miserable excuse for hackneyed formula writing. Our hero wouldn't act that way. Our lead won't allow her character to act that way. Our people wouldn't act that way. No, indeed not. What they can do is act the same damned predictable way each and every week in each and every new situation. Never mind that human beings are irrational and unpredictable and an amalgam of good and bad and smart and dumb. Never mind that the most universal reason that most of us do anything, even if it gets us in trouble or messes us up, is that it seemed like a good idea at the time. Never mind that making these characters unchanging gave them about as much depth as a saucer of oatmeal. Never mind that common sense tells us that if you jam a mixed crew of approximately 450 people into an interstellar tuna fish can for extended periods, that maybe, possibly, what do you think, someone might just get a touch cranky with someone else?" End quote. As I say, Ellison is a fantastically entertaining writer, especially when he's angry. But his point was that Kirk was far more interesting as the guy who's willing to let Edith Keeler live because he loves her, and not being the perfect hero, as Spock comments in the end of the teleplay, never was a woman loved more, because never was any other woman, never was anyone else offered the universe for love.
What do you think the chances are that's one of those famous Shatner rewrites, by the way? It seems like it's an easy mark there, that Spock was going to finish out the episode, and then Shatner said, that's not good writing, the hero should do that.
It's interesting you bring that up, because as Ellison tells the story, William Shatner knew that he was working on this script, and William Shatner was very eager to read Harlan Ellison's script as soon as it was finished, and pestered Ellison for weeks asking when the script was going to be finished. And so as soon as Ellison finished it on a Saturday, he called up William Shatner and said, it's done. And Shatner said, okay, I'll be there in 20 minutes. Don't go anywhere. And comes roaring over on his motorcycle. Ellison hands him the script and then goes and does all the housework that he's been putting off for the past 3 weeks while he's been writing, something that I'm sure you have no understanding of whatsoever. And the whole time Ellison's puttering around cleaning his house, Shatner's sitting on the couch, doing a full read-through of the script, puts it down, stares off into space, picks it up, does a second, much slower read-through of the script, then proceeds to go through it a third time. What Ellison finally figured out a couple of months later, Shatner had been sitting there on the couch, counting up the number of lines that were assigned to Captain Kirk, and that were assigned to Leonard Nimoy as Mr. Spock, found out that Leonard Nimoy had approximately half a dozen more lines than he did, and then went roaring off to Gene Roddenberry to complain that the episode, as written, absolutely would not do and had major problems and had to be changed. And so if he was willing to do that over lines, that also makes me strongly suspect that you're right. And he also wanted to make sure that he got to be the hero of the piece, saving the universe, and not just the poor schmuck who fell in love.
Shatner. Your reputation travels the galaxy.
You'd like to say that's being unkind to Shatner, but having read all of the multiple tell-all books from everyone else involved in Star Trek, you're like, no, that pretty much rings true.
And yet you still kind of like him.
Yeah, the charm of the man.
Okay, so yeah, you're right. That was a pretty big difference. Are there any other really big differences? Because otherwise I'm inclined to go through the smaller changes that I appreciate the logic of, or at least see the reasons for.
The big difference, and I think you're going to talk about this, so I won't really mention it. The other big difference that Harlan Ellison really dislikes between his original teleplay and the as-shot script is the elimination of Trooper. Harlan Ellison really, really loved that character, and it absolutely killed him that Trooper was cut out of the final version entirely, or almost entirely. The thing I'll mention is that the difference between Kirk letting Edith Keeler die and Spock letting Edith Keeler die actually goes to Spock's character himself. There's a slightly earlier episode in season one of Star Trek called The Galileo Seven, where you get another look at Spock's very coldly logical outlook on life. There's a shuttlecraft that has seven crew members, shuttlecraft being called the Galileo, that's crash-landed on a planet. Spock is one of the seven. They've lost a fair bit of fuel in the crash, and they calculate that if they're going to take off again, they need to make the shuttle approximately 500 pounds lighter, and the only good way, this is after they've thrown out chairs and extraneous equipment and anything else to get rid of, they still need another 500 pounds. It's about the weight of three crew people. And Spock is ready to just start basically lining everyone up and going, okay, useful, useful, sort of useful, not really, not really. Okay, you're the three that get left behind, and do this very logical, rational, cost-benefit calculation of who can we afford to leave behind us or who will we miss the least. And this is a key thing that goes on throughout the entire episode, is Spock acting very inhuman, because he's not human, and being willing to allow the good of the many to outweigh the good of the few. And so having Spock allow Edith Keeler to die in this episode is just a reinforcement of his character and the fact that he's not one of us, he's not human, he is an alien, and he does look at things differently than we do.
That matches up nicely. Just based on how television works, I doubt that Harlan Ellison was too aware of that, unless he was part of the writer's room.
No, not really. I think they got to talk to the actors and the other writers a little bit just to get a feel for who the characters were, but it almost seems as though he and the other writer were kind of operating off of the same Spock is super logical kind of background info.
Yeah, it's a really easy and digestible kind of summary of a character for someone to grab hold of. Trooper is the hobo, correct?
Correct. The soldier who had been in the Battle of Verdun and had lost both of his legs.
Who, amusingly, in the comic book that is the teleplay illustrated, is drawn and painted to look like Harlan Ellison himself.
Oh, now I'm going to hate myself for not picking up on that. Good catch.
Yeah, actually, I guess he's worth mentioning right off the bat, because no, he does. He isn't just a cold, calculated change. He had in the teleplay thematic resonance, if you will, the secondary sort of concern. I really enjoyed the coda there, because that's interestingly, you know, when at the end of the story in the teleplay where Kirk is monologuing about the thoughts that he's had as a result of this adventure, part of it is about the woman he loved, but the rest of it is about Trooper, the hobo who was a war veteran. And in the story, in the original teleplay, the war veteran just kind of helps him out a little bit. It's not even that important how. But he does get vaporized. And what's interesting about that, of course, is that Edith Keeler dies and the whole timeline changes, but Trooper dies and it doesn't really matter. And the Time Lords, or not the Time Lords, of course, that's Doctor Who, but the Great Gateway or whatever it's called, says that he mattered, but he's negligible. And it's this interesting cold idea that Kirk has trouble accepting, that this heroic man who life was so tough on and who fought at this major battle was negligible. But it's a great little moment and a great idea. And of course, in the actual episode, you have a nameless hobo who picks up Bones' phaser and accidentally vaporizes himself. And that is Trooper. That's the extent of Harlan Ellison's favorite character.
it's not easy to see why that might tick him off. It's just another example of where I think Ellison's dialogue is really good. Because at the end of the teleplay, Spock says, "He found Beckwith for us. He must have counted." And one of the Guardians of Forever says, "He counted, but not enough. Not in the eternal flow, the greater river." And just a reflection on you can both matter and not matter at the same time. And that's just one of those elements of life that, as disquieting as it may be, it is a reality. And I like that was stuck into the show just as a small, or in the teleplay as a small element of, just something to ponder outside of the bigger events of the story.
Yeah, I think the mark of a good Star Trek script, as few as I've seen, is giving you something to chew on afterward. You know, so many of the scripts are based on philosophical quandaries or, you know, other dilemmas. They pit values against each other, which is one of the great strengths of the series. And I think this is a really good example.
Something I'd like to mention just visually that we get is we've been mentioning once or twice the Guardian of Forever, which is the entity that speaks to the crew before they go back into time and helps them set things up so that they can go back and forth in time. And there's a fairly significant difference between the show and the teleplay. In the show, the Guardian of Forever is a big, round, kind of squashy donut-shaped rock that's hollow in the center and shows the past, and people can just jump through it to go into the past, and the rock is what's speaking to them, and it is, in some weird sense, the Guardian of Forever. In the teleplay, there's actually Guardians of Forever, multiple, and Ellison had envisioned the camera kind of zooming in on what looks like men, but such men as have never before been seen. The instant impression is of age, old, terribly old as time itself, as old as the dying sun overhead. 9 feet tall, gray silver in tone, shapeless beneath the long white robes that reach to the mist-laden ground. They seem incredibly tall, not merely because they are a motionless 9 feet in height, but because of their hair which rises up like mitered headpieces, because of the beards that hang down from their silent and ancient faces. Though only their heads show, they seem almost religious in tone. There is a vast dignity and immense holiness about them. They do not move. Ever. And for a beat, we suspect they may be stone. And then Kirk and Spock actually talk to these characters, and the comic renders it beautifully, showing you the Guardians of Forever who are protecting the time vortex. I think when I first read this teleplay and when I first saw the comic, that was maybe just visually the one thing I was most disappointed got lost between the transition, because I thought those Guardians would have looked awesome on screen.
That was an excerpt from Ellison's teleplay?
That was an excerpt from his teleplay.
Ellison writes scripts like Alan Moore does. The word is that one issue of Alan Moore's Watchmen, the script actually clocked in at, you know, something ridiculous like 100 pages.
Because that gets turned into like 7 or 8 pages of actual comic material, right?
Yeah. wow. So minor notes. In the teleplay, you don't just learn that the timeline has been changed. In the actual episode, Bones jumps through the portal and the Guardians of Forever make a public service announcement, which is that everything is now different. Whereas in the teleplay, Ellison performs the duty of actually showing you that the USS Enterprise is now full of weird barbarian-like peoples instead of the officers that they left on board in the first place. So it shows rather than tells. And in theory, exactly the right call. I wonder if the episode itself in televised form wasn't too short for that. I don't know. It seems like with the amount of ground they had to cover that, taking a quick foray back onto the Enterprise was probably too time consuming. So I didn't mind that cut.
So interesting background info again from our teleplay book, which again, all of our listeners should read because it's thoroughly fascinating. For all of the talk about Harlan being unwilling to bend and unwilling to compromise, that scene with them beaming up to the Enterprise and discovering it being populated by rogue space pirates is something that Ellison put into the first draft of the teleplay because Gene Roddenberry insisted that it be there. Ellison thought it was the stupidest thing. Because
really? He
heard enough about the initial season one scripts to know Roddenberry had a fixation with the Enterprise itself being in danger in practically every episode, which is something I hadn't really thought about until Ellison mentioned it. But then I think back to all the episodes and it's like, yeah, 3/4 or 7/8 of them, the Enterprise was in danger of being completely taken over or blown up. Roddenberry had a fixation on that. And so when Harlan Ellison developed his original script treatment before he wrote the teleplay, Roddenberry said, "That sounds good, but the Enterprise isn't in enough peril. What can you throw in there that has the Enterprise in peril?" And so Ellison threw in this stuff with beaming up to discover it being populated by rogues, which is even in the teleplay something that's dropped rather quickly and never come back to. And then was something that once the suits at NBC saw what was there, that was one of the first things they wanted cut before the episode got finished. So, yeah, it wasn't originally supposed to be there. I always, before I'd read what Ellison had written about the teleplay, I'd thought it was an odd thing to have in there in the first place. But apparently it was a Gene Roddenberry special.
Okay. I mean, it does seem inefficient. And doubtless why it was cut, so that makes a lot of sense. Well, here's another one. I thought it was a perfectly good idea to replace the kind owner of the basement where Spock and Kirk end up living during their time in the 20th century with Edith Keeler herself, and simply having them jump into the basement of her homeless shelter. Now, there's no particular reason why those two characters couldn't be merged, and it saves space and time. You just jump right into the romance.
Yeah, that's something that didn't bother me at all in that transition. Edith Keeler herself, obviously Harlan Ellison liked, he wrote her. All of her stuff in the episode about peace and humanity reaching for the stars was Gene Roddenberry script inserts, because Roddenberry had that very utopian vision for Star Trek, and he wanted to put all those words into Edith Keeler's mouth. That was something that Harlan Ellison was grumpy about. It wasn't one of his like top three complaints about the changes, but it's one. I almost think the teleplay as originally written works a little bit better there, because she comes off as less, she honestly comes off as kind of hippy dippy in the episode. Kind of dishy. I liked her better in the teleplay, I think.
I think the, instead of simply happening on a nice person that, you know, there's her motivation to help homeless people works really well. Oh, there's some homeless men in my basement. They need work. Okay, let's go to work. You know, that worked really well for me. As far as her being obsessed with the idea that one day humanity will go out into the stars, and how very helpful is that? Yeah, Roddenberry's dialogue, if that's what it was, is very unsubtle about it. She hits the nail on the head just a little too perfectly there, and I do remember wincing a bit when I watched the show. This idea that, you know, which Star Trek itself was born of, that we're destined for better things, and that technology was about to send us careening into a better future, where we wouldn't have to worry about so many of the problems that we're facing, that we're facing people then, and which are still facing us now, was very real back then. In fact, there were these science fiction clubs from which modern fandom has kind of descended, that were all about this optimistic vision. So I have no trouble believing that they run across this woman who's very taken with the idea, and that just being sort of a cute way of bonding with Kirk. But I do agree that as Roddenberry wrote it, it was a little too clever by half.
I think I like your words, unsubtle.
I also prefer, and I'm interested in whether you agree, but I prefer Spock creating a time monitoring device out of 20th century bits and parts, silly as that is, over the Guardians of Forever deciding to give Kirk a poem to get on with as he jumps back in time to save the universe. Of course, the poem or these vague clues that the Guardians of the Future give him turn out to be what he needs in order to figure out that Edith Keeler is the person they're looking for. But that is far more contrived for me than Spock just coming up with this wacko invention.
Yeah, and in both the teleplay and in the TV show, they're a little bit up a creek because the tricorder that has all of the information that they need has burned itself out. And having Spock essentially rebuilding the tricorder out of, as he puts it, stone knives and bearskins is credit to DC Fontana, who was one of the writers at the time, or actually just worked for Roddenberry and was getting into writing. And she was the one who did most of the principal rewrites on the script, something she didn't tell Harlan Ellison about for 30 years because she was afraid of his rather volcanic reaction. She did finally come clean to him. But that particular element, the running gag of every time you see Spock trying to repair the tricorder, his apparatus and setup has gotten more expensive and bigger and not expensive. His setup has gotten more expansive and elaborate and convoluted. And that was entirely DC Fontana's work. And I think she did a fantastic job with it. I agree. I like that part of the television episode.
Cool. Speaking of Spock, I also appreciated Harlan Ellison's teleplay, which gives Spock this contempt for the 20th century. He's much more judgmental of 20th century America than the actual episode is, which I would attribute probably to the mores of 50s and 60s television. You know, can't... that sort of social commentary, does it fly as much? I'm curious now, maybe I'm wrong. Do original series episodes have, you know, that, just shy of communist, commentary about how, well, there's no reason for all this. There's enough food for everyone.
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge part of Roddenberry's vision. Yeah. Roddenberry comes across as pseudo-communist in his utopianism, but most of the other episodes had it rather more veiled as to what they were talking about, so that you would still get angry letters from people, but you could say, well, no, that's not what the episode was about. It was obviously about the aliens, not about people in 1950s Georgia.
Sure.
And this episode, if it had been filmed as written, would have been, I think, rather too on the nose, perhaps, for some of its audience.
Yeah, I mean, this is all supposition, but I after watching the episode, I thought to myself, I can see why that was taken out. That doesn't surprise me at all, that wound up on the cutting room floor.
I think it is significant to the character development, though, in that in the teleplay, Spock is hostile not only to 1930s humanity, but a little bit to humanity in general, and even a little bit to Kirk himself. And we go from having a very bristly, prickly Spock who is lumping Kirk in with the people who just tried to lynch him, to at the end of the episode having a Spock who has been affected by Beckwith trying to rescue Edith Keeler and is beginning to have a little bit of a softened attitude, and then calls Captain Kirk Jim for the first time and treats him with something other than just cold formality.
Yeah, I quite liked that too. It might have been a step too far in character development for a mere episode of the television series.
No, I think it would have worked. And there might have been elements of that survived a little bit. I didn't pay attention to what Spock was calling Captain Kirk in the television show. But it would have been appropriate and typical, I think, for the show.
Okay. I believe you. Was there anything else that we hadn't mentioned?
Only other thing I'll mention is that in the television show, as you mentioned, Bones injects himself with a drug and with a full... massive overdose of the drug that turns him paranoid and sends him careening off into the past. Harlan thought that was the stupidest thing he'd ever seen. Dr. Leonard McCoy was one of the foremost surgeons in the United Federation of Planets. That's why he was assigned to the foremost flagship of the Federation fleet. and was sent out on this exploratory mission, Dr. McCoy should not have been the kind of person who was careless enough with his drugs and his hyposprays to accidentally inject himself with a massive overdose of a drug. Harlan despised that. And in fact, one of the alternate drafts that he prepared for Gene Roddenberry had a draft where he threw out Beckwith and had McCoy as the person going into the past, but he had a much better explanation for how it was that McCoy ended up in a frenzied, paranoid state that didn't involve McCoy being dumb enough to inject himself with his own medications.
Succinctly speaking, what was the explanation? I'm interested.
There had been all these time waves emanating from the planet doing various things, and so McCoy and Spock had been doing some experiments, and one of the experiments was on a beastie. They'd picked up on another planet that had been poisoned, and they could actually see the effects of the poisoning running backwards in the little creature. But the poison was still in the creature's bloodstream. The Enterprise hits a wave of turbulence that throws them around the medical bay. They crash into the cage where the creature is, half smashing the cage, just enough for the creature to put its mouth out and clamp down and bite McCoy on the hand, which injects enough of the poison into McCoy's bloodstream to give him some of the frenzied, paranoid reaction that the little animal had been exhibiting from the poison. And then things go off from there.
Yeah, well, that does work better. It still contributes to a bit of heavy lifting. I wonder why you couldn't just start the episode. Captain's log. Bones got bit by a, you know, finished the mission on the poison planet, but McCoy got bitten by a poisonous beast, and now he's crazy as a June bug. And then go from there. William Shatner. And now he's crazy as a June bug. Animaniacs, the television series, gave me, was my first exposure to having fun with Shatner narration. You can certainly see from a production standpoint why that decision was made. Terrible for the themes and all the rest, but do we want to hire another actor and benchmark one of our main characters? Or main actors? Or do we want to find a way to work him in so that all of our main actors are on stage for most of the screen time?
And in fact, now that I think about it, I don't even know if McCoy was in the original teleplay. Again, because Harlan Ellison didn't think it was reasonable for the ship's chief doctor to be beaming down to every stray planetoid they happened to cross, which is an eminently reasonable point to make, but when you've hired DeForest Kelly as one of your leads, you're not going to leave DeForest Kelly behind if you can help it.
Right, no. You gotta, you have to embrace the conceits of the series to some degree, and that's one of them. Sorry, get with the program, Harlan.
So I think we've talked through most of what we both wanted to talk through. To bring this back around, we've watched and we've read two different versions of the show, and there's been this huge controversy over did Roddenberry save Harlan Ellison's script? Was Harlan Ellison's original teleplay good enough to stand on its own? Now that you've seen both, I'm curious what your thoughts are as to the controversy.
Insofar as how inferior a work the episode is as compared to the teleplay. From a distance, if you put them both on a board in front of me, it is very clear that Ellison's work is much better, that he knows what he's talking about, that he has something to say, and that he's saying it, and that he's doing it well. And yet, maybe this is as much a fault of the comic artist and editor as Harlan Ellison, but I find myself having enjoyed the episode more.
Interesting. I would not have expected that.
Yeah, maybe it's benefiting from a certain amount of bias. I don't know. There's this inherent fun in going back and seeing this old-timey production with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy performing their iconic roles and whatnot. But it does move along at a quicker pace. You know, it's definitely a lot of the excess is shed, or it's a bulkier thing in the teleplay version. Everything kind of settles.
Yeah, I think that's true. There's maybe a little bit of ponderousness to it that the TV show doesn't have, and part of that could be DeForest Kelly. I absolutely love DeForest Kelly as an actor doing Leonard McCoy, and would hate to not have that. I think, as written, the teleplay is the better story at identifying and going through themes and having meaningful themes. And I find myself wishing we'd gotten the version of the story where William Shatner and Gene Roddenberry hadn't tried or hadn't had the visceral anti-reaction that they did, and that we would have gotten a version of the story in which DC Fontana and Harlan Ellison actually went back and forth on a couple of different drafts and came up with something that was a little bit of a melding of the two, rather than Roddenberry essentially ignoring Ellison's input and just assigning DC Fontana to rewrite it herself.
Yeah, there's definitely a better version of the story that could come of melding the two's various strengths. I personally envision an episode in which a Trooper is completely removed, or, you know, reduced to a seconds role, and in which Kirk fails to, you know, master himself, and it is Spock who ends up having to save the universe at the fateful moment. Those would be my main changes.
I do think you could have had Kirk wanting to save Edith Keeler and trying to save Edith Keeler in the TV episode, and maybe that one change alone would have elevated the TV episode quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it in one. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to. And the rest is, I mean, let's face it, there is a bit of fat on Harlan Ellison's teleplay. There's a battle with Beckwith in the alleys that you don't really need. It's just there to keep the race, the hunt for him going, if
right.
you will.
Yeah.
So, I think the slimmer version with Harlan Ellison's original ending and killing his darling, as all writers are supposed to do, would do the trick.
So we've been going, you know, this whole episode was supposed to be in memoriam to Harlan Ellison, and I kind of think we've done that. He's written some great stories that I've never read and that honestly I would like to look up and find and read. And if you, our gentle Vox Populi, find links to these stories on the show notes when the episode is published, then you'll know that I've spent the intervening 3 or 4 days actually tracking them down and providing them for you. If not, my apologies.
You're so helpful, Joe.
But there are stories I've never read that I would like to, that Harlan is justifiably well known for, at least among sci-fi authors. But I think The City on the Edge of Forever is probably going to be, in popular imagination, what he's best known for going forward. And I think the whole story around this episode is maybe a good way to remember Harlan Ellison, because it illustrates his very passionate and intense and no-holds-barred writing style. If you read nothing else of his, reading his thoughts on the controversy and how it developed over a 30-year period will give you a very good understanding of who Harlan Ellison was and what he was like.
Well said. And with that, I think we're going to be parting ways for a short while, but coming back soon in order to discuss another dead giant, because that's the age at which we're at. Joe, we're now at the point where all of the people who were worshipped in our youth are now just kicking the bucket one at a time. Really, we could make a whole podcast out of it.
Just watch them fall one by one and commemorate them as they go. No, we'll be spending the next episode
watching your heroes fall one by one. Death Watch. No, there's a good title here. The Deadpool? No, then the wrong fans will show up.
And we kind of already did that for our Thanos cast. No, we're going to spend the next episode talking about comic books and letting you know why you should be paying attention to comic books and where and how you can pay attention to comic books, and perhaps even a little bit about who mattered in the history of comic books.
Yes, it was only 5 days ago as we're recording this, but over a week by the time you hear it, that one of the masters was found to have passed away in his apartment, Mr. Steve Ditko, and we'll be talking about him next time on The Golden Age.
Until then, Vox Populi. Until then.
If you liked the show, help new listeners find it by listening to The Golden Age and rating it in Apple Podcasts. Just go into Apple Podcasts, subscribe to The Golden Age, and rate it. You can also see announcements for new shows, episodes, and upcoming live streams by following at From Vox Duo on Twitter. Joe blogs at minorthoughts.com and is on Twitter at jmartindf. Adam is on Twitter as well, at Adam Volley. That's Adam, VOLLE.